In a wonderful journey of the letter of St. Paul to the Romans, that's what we'll do this morning. And I'll spend the first little part introducing it to you. Paul was in Ephesus here, teaching 3 years, with a lot of contact with Corinth. He left here in 55 AD, we think, after Pentecost sometime, headed north to Troas. I'll come back on this in a minute. Then he went over to Macedonia. He wrote back to Corinth because Titus had met him and said things were improving in Corinth. So he wrote what we know as the second letter to the Corinthians, at least the first 9 chapters. He spent the winter here in Macedonia. And then in the spring of the following year, 56, he seems, as far as we can tell, to have done a mission in western Macedonia and the southern part of Illyricum, present Dalmatian coast. And then Titus met him again and he hurried off the letter we finished last week, those last 4 chapters, 10, 11, 12, 13 of 2 Corinthians. And he came down here before the winter of 56. And remember, their winter covers our Christmas period, so it's the end of the year. And he stayed in, as I'll show you in a moment, Corinth for 3 months prior to heading off to Jerusalem with the collection which he's been gathering for the poor in Jerusalem. And his intention at that stage was to go to Rome. So, while in Corinth, in the early months, the winter months of 57 AD, that's the most probable date, he wrote the letter we're about to read. What makes the letter quite special is that apart from the letter to the Colossians, which he'd written from Ephesus, Colossae is just over here, which was to a community that he hadn't visited. So the letter to the Colossians is written to, in a sense, strangers, though he knew some of the members of the community. And that's very different, isn't it, from writing a letter to people you know well and have lived with for years. So apart from that letter, which is quite brief and has one beautiful but intense focus, all his other letters we've done up to this date, and we've done 7, have been written to Thessalonica, 2 of them, Corinth, 2 of them, Philemon that he wrote to, the Galatians over here that he'd met, people that he'd lived with, loved, spoken to, preached with, and had problems and wrote letters to him, and he was answering their letters. And it's the letters kind of go all over, not all over the place, but they cover quite a range of topics. The beauty of this letter is he's writing to a new community that he hopes to visit, intends to visit, and he's also on his way to Jerusalem, where he's not expecting a very good welcome. It's a very difficult place for him to visit because a lot of the Jerusalem Christians were still hurt that Christianity seemed to be leaving Judaism. It's becoming largely Gentile. So they had the opinion that you should become a Jew in order to be a Christian, because after all, Jesus was a Jew and all the apostles were. It's a reasonable position to hold. But this missionary activity of Paul, for many of them were the other way too, it was a problematic area. And the Jews in Jerusalem saw this ex-Pharisee turned Christian as a traitor, as you'd well imagine, to their faith, their Jewish faith. So it's a tough place to go to, and I suggest that what Paul was doing is 2 things. He's writing ahead to Rome to counter any rumours that might have got to Rome about what he was teaching, to put his teaching really clearly for Rome. And so since he doesn't have to answer letters or particularly cope with problems of the community, which he's not aware of, though he has some knowledge of it, you can see what I mean. He's writing a thesis, really. It's his gospel. It's his view of Christianity to be sent off there. But keep in mind, also, he was probably writing it to get himself ready to defend his gospel in Jerusalem. So he's got two prongs to this very important letter. It's still a polemic letter. It's still an argument letter. It's a letter against accusers. So it's got a... It's not just completely free. In fact, according to the opinion I follow, the Ephesian letter, which is the next one we'll study, I think is his most beautiful letter, because there's no argument in it. He's not defending anything. He's simply saying what Christ means to him. So that's just a gem, the letter to the Ephesians, without any... But this is necessarily a tough, logical, argued position for what Christianity really is about. So he's here in Corinth, you're right, so imagine yourself in the middle of winter, it's a bit hard yet, but, and you're in Corinth, snowed in, so he's writing his little letter away there, and not too many visitors, but not too many phone calls, and no email, thank God, so he's got a bit of space, and he's writing his, what it means to him to be a Christian. He intends going to Rome. Some think, and it could be right, and I'll read to you now from the Acts of the Apostles. I'm going back a fair way. I'll go back to chapter 16. Paul had headed off from Antioch, which is over here, and it says, I'll read it to you, chapter 16, verse 6 of the Acts. They went through the region of Phrygia and Galatia, having been forbidden by the Holy Spirit to speak the word in Asia. Asia is Asia Minor, the Roman province here around Ephesus, western Turkey. Forbidden by the Holy Spirit. In other words, in prayer, he seems to have been heading towards Ephesus. But somehow in prayer, he discerned that somehow God didn't want that of him. So he's trying to discern and follow the will of God. And so it says, when they came opposite Mysia, which is here, that's the Dardanelles there, that's Troas. When they came to Mysia, they attempted to go into Bithynia, which is on the southern coast of the Black Sea. But the Spirit of Jesus didn't allow them. Once again, I don't know how to talk about it any more than the Acts of the Apostles does, but he discerned that's not what God wanted him. So they went down to Troas. This is in the year 49 AD, so 7-8 years prior to his writing this letter. He gets to Troas, and during the night, it says, Paul had a vision. There stood a man of Macedonia, pleading with him and saying, come over to Macedonia and help us. And when he'd seen the vision, we immediately tried to cross over to Macedonia, being convinced that God had called us to proclaim the good news to them. It's his first visit out of Asia, as it was called, into Europe. This is at the end of 49 AD. And he goes to Neapolis, Philippi, Thessalonica. This is my suggestion as a possibility. There's a famous Roman road, the Via Appia, which goes from Rome down to present Brindisi, just on the kind of heel of, a bit north of the heel of Italy, and then a very short crossing over here to Dyrrachium or Apollonia, short sea crossing. Then it's called the Via Egnatia. It's the same road with a little bit of sea. And the Via Egnatia runs from Dyrrachium through Thessalonica, through Philippi, over to here. So in 49, Paul was on the Via Egnatia. He was at Philippi, had to leave, went to Thessalonica. Was Paul already heading for Rome in the year 49? That could have been, where he had in mind that maybe God's calling me to Rome. But through persecution and all the rest, we had to go south, and then we've done the rest of the story. So that's back in 49. I'll read to you from Acts chapter 19 now, verse 21. Paul now is in Ephesus. We're in the year 55. And it says, after these things had been accomplished, Paul resolved in the Spirit, meaning in prayer, of course, to go through Macedonia and Achaia, and then to go on to Jerusalem. He said, after I have gone there, I must also see Rome. So he's come to a firmer decision now in the year 55 to head towards Rome. And that's in his mind as he says goodbye to these people here and as he comes down to Corinth. Let's talk about the Christians in Rome just for a few moments. We know from the books of the Maccabees, which you may or may not have read, that there were Jews in Rome, certainly, in the 2nd century before Christ. So 150, 168, in fact, so probably from about the year 200 at least BC, there's a Jewish community, or a number of Jewish communities, in Rome. Now, the Jewish community in Rome, and that's who Paul is basically writing to, in 63 BC, Pompey, the Roman general, conquered Palestine and so included Palestine in the Roman Empire, going right around the verge, you know, the outside of the Mediterranean Sea. And we're told, the estimation is that there were 50,000 Jews in Rome, slaves brought back from the war mostly by different families. Generals in the army brought them back and then sold them in the marketplace. So most of the Jews in Rome would have been slaves. By the time we get to the time we are, which is now 100 years later, a lot of them had been freed. So they were called freedmen. They'd worked their way through their slavery and they're free. And others would have been there as merchants, bankers, you know, organizing money and finance and so on. 50,000 Jews in Rome at that time. We know there were Jews from Rome at Pentecost. If you read the Acts of the Apostles on Acts chapter 2, it mentions Rome as one of the places they're there from. We'll find at the end of our letter, in chapter 16, verse 10 to 11, that there are slaves in Rome whom Paul addresses in the house, or he talks about the household of Aristobulus and Narcissus. I'll talk about them later. They're probably fairly high-ranking Romans, and they themselves are not Christian, but the household is. So we're talking about the slaves that belong, you're welcome, belong to these houses in Rome. Another important insight to get that I was pleased I managed to get is, don't presume when Paul is writing in 56 and 57, that Christmas period, don't presume that there'd been a break between the Christians and the Jews yet. See, we're inclined to think a bit that you've got the Christian community over there and the Jewish community in the synagogue here. The real break between Christians and Jews didn't really happen till the destruction of Jerusalem. That was in Jerusalem. And it happened at different stages in different parts of the empire, and it happened at different stages in different communities. Can you imagine? So I'm not sure, no one's sure, so I'm not sure whether at this stage all the Christian Jews may still have been going to the synagogue with their Christian brothers and sisters. They would also meet in their homes on the first day of the week to have the Eucharist, to share break bread, the breaking of bread and all that. But they didn't stop being Jews. Paul himself, of course, Jesus never stopped being a Jew, neither did Paul. You don't have to stop being anything to become a Christian. You bring all that you are into this community of love. So I think that's worth keeping in mind. And from the end of the Acts of the Apostles, when Paul actually gets to Rome, it says he called the leaders of the Jewish community together. It doesn't say Jewish Christians. The leaders of the Jewish community came and they discussed things with him. So there's probably, I would think, there's a lot of interaction going on, and that Paul's letter may well have been read out in the whole synagogue. And that's the way, I think it's a good way to assume it. So you can imagine your daughter has become a Christian. That's you. Now you're the Jewish community in Rome, all right? So your daughter's become a Christian. Your wife has. you don't want to do it, you think you shouldn't, so you're sitting there as a Jew, and that's good. And, you know, and the families are all a bit searching, and it's a time of flux and a time of evangelism, but also a time of where the break may not yet have come, at least universally in Rome. The only other thing to say is from the map that I gave you a moment ago, which I've now lost, here it is, when Paul first came to Corinth, here, back in 50 AD, 6 years earlier, you might recall he met a couple that had been sent out of Rome by Claudius, Aquila and Prisca. And they also worked in the same trade as Paul, tent makers or saddlers, leather workers. And he moved in with them, and they worked together and had the same... He kind of became an extra member of their group, making the stuff for the camels and so on. That was back in 50. He took them over to Ephesus with him. When he writes now, in 56, 57, to Rome, he writes it also to Aquila and Prisca. So they've clearly gone back to Rome. Why have they gone back to Rome? Because the Edict of Claudius ceased in 54 when Nero became emperor. When these edicts that emperors gave were automatically stopped when the emperor died. So in 54 they would have been free to go back home, which is where they'd made... So obviously they set off back to Rome because they're back in Rome in 56, this couple. A few more little things about the community before we start the text. The community was not founded by Paul. I've already made that point, and it's quite important to keep it in mind. And he writes, chapter 1, verse 12, we'll look at it in a moment. I'm writing, he said, that we may be mutually encouraged by each other's faith. So he's not writing it as an apostle to them. They've already been a Christian community. He's writing as a fellow Christian to them, who is an apostle, but he's writing and he wants to offer them his faith, and he wants to receive theirs from them too. It's a mutual sharing. He's writing to a community, he says, as we'll see in verse 8, whose faith is proclaimed throughout the world. And at the end of the letter, he will read, they're a community full of goodness, filled with all knowledge, able to instruct one another. So he's heard a lot about the maturity of this Christian community. And it's... their company, he says, I hope to enjoy your company. He asks for their prayers. We'll read all this later. But he's still writing as an apostle to the Gentiles, because that's what he is. He'll say that. And as one who's conscious of the authority vested in him by God. He writes, he says, so that I may share with you some spiritual gift to strengthen you and to proclaim the gospel to you also who are in Rome. Lastly, as an introduction, and then I'll pause and see how you're going, I'd like to open your mind at the beginning to some of the key issues that we'll find in Romans. Now, it's up to you to check this as you go through. This is my discernment of the letter, but you've got the text, so you can read it for yourselves and see if this is how it comes across to you. But I thought it would be worth at least letting you know what I've come to as a result of my study before I begin. The first point, the key theme of our letter, is the universality of God's plan of salvation. Paul is terrifically conscious of the fact that Christianity is for everybody. That what Jesus did, there's no one left out. No nation, no person, nobody. It's the love of the one God. So obviously everyone's included in the love. And the love has been shown in Jesus. God is already there working in people in all cultures, in all of history, of course. The Spirit of God is drawing everyone towards God. But now in Jesus we can see who God really is, God of love. And so Paul wants everyone to know that the God who is calling them is this God of love shown by Jesus, and it's for everyone. It was critically important for Paul that the Jews and Gentiles live in a communion of love. And all his life he struggled with that. and did his best, and it was a beautiful best, but it was a difficult thing because the Jewish community, their leaders on the whole, well, you know, Jesus was crucified, and then a lot of their followers were as well. So it was hard for Jews to break free from the cultic and cultural binds that they were in. It's hard for any community to do that. You try and break away from the faith of your childhood and you'll find it's not at all easy because you've been beautifully kind of nurtured in it. So it wasn't easy to do, but it was. Paul's point is in this letter, you don't have to break away from your culture. You have to take another step, however, into the world community of Christianity. So the importance respectful of each other and accepting each other with all their differences. And this is the first letter. The bulk of the community in Rome, I presume at this time, was Jewish. There was a very large Jewish community with many synagogues in Rome at this time, and Christianity took root in that Jewish community. So it's unlike the other places Paul is writing to, which are largely Gentile. And there's a very close connection, we know this from other sources as well, between the Jews in Jerusalem and the Jews in Rome. There's a lot of interaction and a lot of connection. Hence Paul's importance to write to them just before he goes to Jerusalem, because their very similar mindset he's dealing with. So that's, I think, one of the key themes that you're going to find as we begin our work today. This was the significance of the collection that he was taking up, which we read about a couple of weeks ago in 2 Corinthians 8 and 9. Now, he's heard, and who's he heard from? I'd say Prisca and Aquila would be in pretty close contact with Paul by letter, and possibly when he gets to Corinth, he's got a letter waiting him there from the boat, it's not very far from Rome, from them saying, hey, things are going pretty well in Rome, but there's a few problems. So he's a little bit aware of the problems that are there. So he's heard that the Gentiles in the Roman community are not sufficiently respecting their Jewish Christians. That's different. When he's been struggling to keep the two together, it's mostly been problems with the Jewish community. In Galatians, you'd know that, and in other Philippians, we'll see later. But in this one, the problem seems to be coming a lot from the Gentiles, who are not sufficiently respecting the beauty of Judaism. At least that's how I read it, and we'll see the evidence of it when we start. Paul wants to make sure in this letter that rejection of Christianity is not caused by the behaviour of Christians. So it's a beautifully moral letter about the kind of behaviour they should be involved in, so that they don't give a bad name to Christianity, and so that they really welcome and be attractive to the pagan community in Rome. Sure, I remind you of the fact, because you may not be aware of it, at this time, in the middle of the first century AD, the estimate, I don't know how they estimate it, is that Europe, the whole of Europe, had a population of between 5 and 6 million. That's the whole of Europe. 1 million were in Rome. I mean, Rome is just an extraordinary city. It's got a sixth or a fifth of the whole population of Europe in it. So it's quite mind-blowing when you look at those figures of this extraordinary city. So there's a vast possibility for mission here, and it is the centre of the empire. It's good to assume that what Paul says about faith is something he expects the Jews to agree to. Now, this is scholarship that I'm sharing with you that's, I shouldn't say modern, but it's not much more than 25 years old, and it takes a while to seep through. There was a time, because Romans, everyone talks about Romans, everyone writes a commentary on Romans. The fact that I've written my third commentary on it just makes me one of a million people. Everybody writes about Romans, as you well know, because of its importance and fascination. But it was common opinion till about 25 years ago that Paul was kind of arguing with the Jews. who was, it was said, believed that, no, it was what you did that mattered. It was not faith, but it was works. And he's saying, no, it's faith that matters. It's interesting, once you confess, I mean, I think all scholars today who really kept up with the literature would disagree with that today. But you see, it makes such a difference to the way you read it. When Paul is writing to the Jews in Rome, he is assuming that they would be agreeing with him on the basis. And from that agreed basis, it's not an argument, from that agreed basis, he wants to show them that Jesus is the natural fruit of that agreement. Do you get it? He's not plastering them with debate where they'd be resisting. He's inviting them in to an agreed common ground on faith and on the nature between faith and works and all that. And from that agreed common ground, he looks at Jesus and says, well, since I know you know this, and he knew it as a Pharisee, wasn't something he learned as a Christian, since I know we both know this, why don't you look at Jesus again and see who he really is? It's a beautiful thing. Do you take my main point? I haven't made it yet. I'll make it for you next week. But it's so different when you start reading Paul as arguing with the Jews, or Paul inviting the Jews into common ground and presenting Jesus as the transcendent and beautiful fulfillment of that common faith. And now, well, yes, well, everyone I read today, there's no one disagrees with that. Like because we know more about Judaism in the first century, that's what's happened. People have discovered from other writings that our prejudiced thoughts about what Jews thought in the first century were actually radically wrong. So we now realize that actually Paul was putting out a common Jewish position from which he was developing his thoughts. So Paul wants to demonstrate that there's a power and a presence and a love and a spirit offered in Jesus, which enables them in true fidelity to the law, that's the key, to go beyond the limits of the law and reach its goal. For myself, in that year I spent in Rome a couple of years ago studying this and nothing else full time, so it was quite a luxury, as you'd imagine, day and night, and it was day and night, and it was only 5 minutes walk from the library that I could spend all day in. And in the meantime, you walk past all the wonderful, if you've been to Rome, all these just amazing places on your way to and from work. So with that kind of luxury and my obsessive, compulsive need to discover, I had a whole year there. And my biggest insight, I knew it before, but sometimes you know things and then you really know them, you know. And my biggest insight was that Paul was so faithful to Judaism that Judaism was what he was. It's what Jesus was. It's a beautiful religion if it's allowed to blossom as it blossomed in Jesus, and if it can be freed from the historical tribal positions that it had taken up before Christ, before it opened to the world. So Christianity is really Judaism liberated to take the God of Moses and Isaac and Abraham, the God now of Jesus, taken to the world. So Paul saw himself as being utterly faithful to the Jewish roots into which he was trained, that he learnt as a Pharisee, but he was freed from the Pharisaic rigidity that stopped this wonderful faith from being welcomed by Gentiles, Greeks, Romans, and everybody else. In other words, he saw the universality of God. Can you see it any other way? There's only one God. So he saw that God loves everybody, and that Jesus liberated, you know, the stories about the Samaritans and the Gentiles in the Gospel. And so he was helping Jews who were not yet at home with Christianity to see that if they became Christian, they were not leaving anything, they were flowering into Christianity. Because you shouldn't leave anything, should you? Anything beautiful in your life or my life, we're supposed to bring it with us. Conversion doesn't mean being different to what I am. It means allowing the beautiful part of me, you, and my training and my teaching and my parents, but we've all got to grow and bringing that into a liberated place.